Senator Pittman, Secretary Ickes, governors of the Colorado state, and you especially, who have built Boulder Dam. This morning, I saw, and I was conquered. As everyone would be who sees for the first time this great feat of mankind. 10 years ago, the place where we are gathered was an unpeopled, forbidding desert. In the bottom of the gloomy canyon, whose precipitous walls rose to a height of more than 1,000 feet, flowed a turbulent, dangerous river. The mountains on either side of the canyon were difficult of access, with neither road nor trail. Their rocks were protected by neither trees nor grass from the blazing heat of the sun. The site of Boulder City was a cactus-covered waste. And the transformation wrought here in these years is a 20th century marvel. We are here to celebrate the completion of the greatest dam in the world. Rising 726 feet above the bedrock of the river and altering the geography of a whole region, we are here to see the creation of the largest artificial lake in the world. 115 miles long, holding enough water, for example, to cover the whole state of Connecticut to a depth of 10 feet. And we are here to see nearing completion a powerhouse which will contain the largest generators and turbines yet installed in this country, machinery that can continuously supply nearly 2 million horsepower of electric energy. All of these dimensions are superlative. They represent and embody the accumulated engineering knowledge and experience of centuries. And when we behold them, it is fitting that we pay tribute to the genius of their designers. We recognize also the energy, the resourcefulness, and the zeal of the builders who, under the greatest physical obstacles, have pushed this work forward to completion 2 years in advance of contract requirements. But especially, my friends, we express our gratitude to the thousands of workers who gave brain and brawn in this great work of construction. Beautiful and great as this structure is, it must also be considered in its relationship to the agricultural and industrial development and in its contribution to the health and comfort of the people of America who live in the Southwest. To divert and distribute the waters of an arid region so that there shall be security of rights and efficiency in service is one of the greatest problems of law and of administration to be found in any government. The farms, the cities, the people who live along the many thousands of miles of this river and its tributaries, all of them depend for their permanence in value upon the conservation, regulation, and the equitable and fair division of its ever-changing water supply. What has been accomplished in the Colorado in working out such a scheme of distribution is inspiring to the whole country. Through the cooperation of the state, whose people depend upon this river, and of the federal government, which is concerned in the general welfare, there is being constructed a system of distributive work and of laws and practices which will ensure to the millions of people who now dwell in this basin and to the millions of others who have come to dwell here in future generations a safe just and permanent system of water rights. In devising these policies and the means of putting them into practice, the Bureau of Reclamation of the federal government has taken and is destined to take in the future a leading and helpful part. The Bureau has been the instrument which gave effect to the legislation introduced into the Congress by Senator Hiram Johnson and Congressman Philip Swing. When in flood, the river was a threatening torrent. In the dry months of the year, it shrank to a trickling stream. For a generation, the people of Imperial Valley had lived in the shadow of disaster from this river, which provided their livelihood and which is the foundation of their hopes for themselves and their children. Every spring, they awaited with dread the coming of a flood. And at the end of every summer, they feared a shortage of water would destroy their crops. The gates of these great diversion tunnels were closed here at Boulder Dam last February. And in June, a great flood came down the river. It came roaring down the canyons of the Colorado through Grand Canyon and Iceberg and Boulder Canyon, but it was caught. It was caught and held safely behind Boulder Dam. Last year, a drought of unprecedented severity was visited upon the West. The watershed of this Colorado River did not escape. In July, the canals of the Imperial Valley went dry. Crop losses in that valley alone totaled $10 million that summer. Had Boulder Dam been completed 1 year earlier, this loss would have been prevented because the spring flood would have been stored to furnish a steady water supply for the long, dry summer and fall. Across the San Jacinto Mountains southwest of Boulder Dam, the cities of Southern California are constructing an aqueduct that costs $200 million, which they have raised, for the purpose of carrying the regulated waters of the river to the Pacific coast, 250 miles away. And across the desert and the mountains to the west and south run great electric transmission lines by which factory motors, streets and household lights, and irrigation pumps can be operated in southern Arizona and California. Part of this power will be used in pumping the water through the aqueduct to supplement the domestic supplies of Los Angeles and surrounding cities. Navigation of the river from Boulder Dam to the Grand Canyon has been made possible. A 115-mile stretch that had been traversed less than half a dozen times in all history. An immense new park has been created for the enjoyment of all of our people. And that is why, my friends, those of you who are not here today but can hear my voice, I tell you, come to Boulder Dam and see it with your own eyes. At what cost was all this done? Boulder Dam and the powerhouses together cost a total of $108 million, all of which will be repaid with interest in 50 years under the contract for the sale of the power. Under these contracts already completed, not only will the cost be repaid, but the way is open for the provision of needed light and power to the consumers at reduced rates. In the expenditure of the price of Boulder Dam, during the Depression years, work was provided for 4,000 men, most of them heads of families, and for many thousands more who were enabled to earn a livelihood through the manufacture of materials and machinery. And my friends, this picture is true on different scales It is true in regard to the thousands of projects undertaken by the federal government, by the states, and by the counties and municipalities in recent years. The overwhelming majority of them are of definite and permanent usefulness. Throughout our national history, we have had a great program of public improvement, and in these past 2 years, all that we have done has been to accelerate that program. We know, too, that the reason for this speeding up was the need of giving relief to several million men and women whose earning capacity had been destroyed by the complexities and the lack of thought of the economic system of the past generation. No sensible person is foolish enough to draw hard and fast classifications as to usefulness or need. Obviously, for instance, this great Boulder Dam warrants universal approval because it will prevent floods and flood damage, because it will irrigate thousands of acres of tillable land, and because it will generate electricity to turn the wheels of many factories and illuminate countless homes. But can we say that a 5-foot brushwood dam across the headwaters of an arroyo and costing only a millionth part of Boulder Dam is an undesirable project or a waste of money? Can we say that the Great Brick High School costing $2 million is a useful expenditure, but that a little wooden schoolhouse project costing $5,000 or $10,000 is a wasteful extravagance? Is it fair to approve a huge city boulevard and disapprove the improvement of a muddy farm-to-market road? These efforts meet with the approval of the people of the nation. In a little over 2 years, this great national work has accomplished much. We have helped mankind by the works themselves, and at the same time, we have created the necessary purchasing power to throw in the clutch to start the wheels of what we call private industry. Such expenditures on all of these works, great and small, flow out to many beneficiaries. They revive other and more remote industries and businesses. Money is put in circulation, credit is expanded, and the financial and industrial mechanism of America is stimulated to more and more activity. Labor makes wealth. The use of materials makes wealth. To employ workers and materials when private employment has failed is to translate into great national possessions the energy that otherwise would be wasted. And Boulder Dam is a splendid symbol of that principle. The mighty waters of the Colorado were running unused to the sea. Today, we translate them into a great national possession. I might go further and suggest to you that use begets use. Such works as this serve as a means of making useful other national possessions. Vast deposits of precious metals are scattered within a short distance of where we stand today. They await the development of cheap power. These great government power projects will affect not only the development of agriculture and industry and mining in the sections that they serve, but they will also prove useful yardsticks to measure the cost of power throughout the United States. It is my belief that the government should proceed to lay down the first yardstick from this great power plant in the form of a state power line, assisted in its financing by the government, and tapping the wonderful natural resources of Southern Nevada. Doubtless the same policy of financial assistance to state authorities can be followed in the development of Nevada's sister state, Arizona, on the other side of the river. With it all, with work proceeding on every one of the more than 3,000 counties of the United States, and of a vastly greater number of local divisions of government, the actual credit of government agencies is on a stronger and safer basis than at any time in the past 6 years. Many states have actually improved their financial position in the past 2 years. Municipal tax receipts are being paid when the taxes fall due, and tax arrearages are steadily declining. Yes, it is a simple fact that government spending is already beginning to show definite signs of its effect on consumer spending. That the putting of people to work by the government has put other people to work through private employment. And that in 2 years and a half, we have come to the point today when private industry must bear the principal responsibility of keeping the processes of greater employment moving forward with accelerated speed. The people of the United States are proud of Boulder Dam, with the exception of the few who are narrow vision. People everywhere, people on the Atlantic seaboard, people in the Middle West and the Northwest, people in the South, must surely recognize that the national benefits which will be derived from the completion of this project will make themselves felt in every one of the 48 states. They know that poverty or distress in a community 2,000 miles away may affect them, and equally that prosperity and higher standards of living across a whole continent will help them back home. Today marks the official completion and the dedication of Boulder Dam, the first of four great government regional units. This is an engineering victory of the first order, another great achievement of American resourcefulness, American skill, and American determination. And that is why I have the right once more to congratulate you who have builded Boulder Dam, and on behalf of the nation to say to you, well done.
I now have the honor to present the President of the United States. my fellow Americans, the living memory of the world war is close to each and every one of us today. Our thoughts return to the great objectives of the past, even as the minds of older men go back to their boyhood's ideals. We Americans were so placed in those days that we gained a perspective of the great world conflict that was perhaps clearer than that of our fellow men who were closer to the scene of battle. For most of the first 3 years of the conflict, we were not participants. But during the final phase, we ourselves engaged on many fronts. For that reason, perhaps, we understood as well as any the cries that went up that the world conflict should be made a war to end war. We were not invaded, nor were we threatened with invasion then or later. But the very distance of our view led us to perceive the dire results of war through days of following peace. The primary purpose of the United States of America is to avoid being drawn into war. We seek also, in every practicable way, to promote peace and to discourage war. Except for those few who have placed or who place temporary selfish gain ahead of national and world peace, the overwhelming mass of American citizens are in hearty accord with these basic policies of our government, as they are also entirely sympathetic with the efforts of other nations to avoid and to end war. So, my friends, that is why we too have striven with great consistency to approve steps to remove the causes of war and to disapprove steps taken by others to commit acts of aggression. We have either led or performed our full part in every important attempt to limit and to reduce world armament. We have sought by definite acts and solemn commitments to establish the United States as a good neighbor among nations. We are acting to simplify definitions and facts by calling war war when armed invasion and the resulting killing of human beings take place. But though our course is consistent and clear, it is with disappointment and sorrow that most Americans confess that the world's gain thus far has been small. I would not be frank with you if I did not tell you that the dangers that confront the future of mankind are, as a whole, greater to the world and therefore to us than the dangers that confront the people of the United States by and in themselves alone. Jealousies between nations continue.
armaments increase, national ambitions that disturb the world's peace are thrust forward. And the most serious of all, international confidence in the sacredness of international contracts is on the wane. The memory of our hopes of 1917 and of 1918 dies with the death of those of us who took part. It is therefore your sacred obligation and mine, by conscious, definite effort, to pass that great memory on to succeeding generations. A new generation, even in its cradle or still unborn, is coming to the fore. The children in our schools, the young men and women passing through our colleges into productive life, have, unlike us, no direct knowledge of the meaning of war. They are not immune to the glamour of war, to the opportunities to escape from the drabness and the worry of hard times at home, in the glory and heroism of the arms factory and the battlefield. Fortunately, there is evidence on every hand that the youth of America as a whole is not trapped by that delusion. They know that elation and prosperity, which may come from a new war, must lead, for those who survive it, to economic and social collapse more sweeping than any we have experienced in the past. While, therefore, we cannot and must not hide our concern for grave world danger, and while at the same time we cannot and must not build walls around ourselves and hide our heads in the sand, we must go forward with all our strength to stress and strive for international peace. And in this effort, America must and will protect herself. Under no circumstances will this policy of self-protection go to lengths beyond self-protection. Aggression on the part of the United States is an impossibility insofar as the present administration of your government is concerned. But defense against aggression by others, adequate defense on land, on sea, and in air, is our accepted policy. And the measure of that defense is and will be solely the amount necessary to guard us, to safeguard us against the armament of others. The more greatly they decrease their armament, the more quickly and surely shall we decrease ours. In many other fields, by word and by deed, we are giving example to the world by removing or lowering barriers which impede friendly intercourse. Our soldier and sailor dead call to us across the years to make our lives effective in building constructively for peace. And it is fitting that on this Armistice Day, 17 years late, I am privileged to tell you that between us and a great neighbor, another act cementing our historic friendship has been agreed upon and is being consummated. Between Canada and the United States exists a neighborliness, a genuine friendship, which for over a century has dispelled every passing rift. Our two people, each independent in themselves, are closely knit by ties of blood and a common heritage. Our standards of life are substantially the same. Our commerce, our economic conditions rest upon the same foundation. Between two such people, if we would build constructively for peace and progress, the flow of intercourse should be mutually beneficial and not unduly hampered. Each has much to gain by material profit, by spiritual profit, by increased employment, through the means of enlarged trade one with the other. And I am therefore happy to be able to tell you, almost in celebration of this Armistice Day, that the Canadian Prime Minister and I, after thoughtful discussion of our national problems, have reached a definite agreement which will eliminate disagreements and unreasonable restrictions, and thus work to the advantage of both Canada and the United States. I hope that this good example will reach round the world someday. For the power of good example is the strongest force in the world. It surpasses preachment. It excels good resolution. And it is far better than agreement unfulfilled. If we as a nation, by our good example, can contribute to the peaceful well-being of the Fellowship of Nations, our course through the years will not have been in vain. We who survive have profited by the good example of our fellow Americans who gave their lives in war. On these surrounding hills of Virginia, they rest, thousands upon thousands, in the last bivouac of the dead. Below us, across the river, we see a great capital of a great nation. The past and the present unite in the prayer that America will ever seek the ways of peace, and by her example, at home and abroad, speed the return of goodwill among men.